You're listening to a podcast by BI Norwegian Business School.
Welcome to the new season of Stay Ahead, a podcast from BI Norwegian Business School. This season, we're exploring entrepreneurship, going beyond the startup. We're talking to entrepreneurs who've done it and researchers who've studied it about the challenges in growing a young business and how entrepreneurs overcome these. I'm your host, Susanna Pinnock. I'm a former entrepreneur myself, and I'm currently doing a PhD in entrepreneurship here at BI. Our topic for today is the role of clusters, support organizations, and international networks in entrepreneurial growth. I'm joined by Agnete Fredriksen. Agnete is the founder and now chief business officer of Oslo-based Nycode Therapeutics. She developed the Vaccibody vaccine molecule, was awarded the King's Gold Medal of Merit, and has many scientific papers and patents to her name. I'm also joined by Heidi Wieg, a professor at the Department of Strategy and Entrepreneurship here at BI and our associate dean in China. She researches regional and global innovation systems and networks, as well as female entrepreneurship. So welcome to you both. Agnete, can we start by asking you to take us back to the early days of Nycode, or Vaccibody as it was then, and tell us a little about when you started to feel like an entrepreneur?
Yeah, so it's been a long journey. It's over 20 years ago I started to design the first Vaccibody molecules. That was purely as a PhD thesis. And I had absolutely no idea about commercialization or patenting or IP or how to start a biotech company. So very different days than from what we have now at university. We started submitting these abstracts and posters to present once some of the data started to be interesting. And that's when, I think by coincidence, someone mentioned that it may be a good idea to submit a patent. And that was 10 days before the conference. So the core patent that our company is based on was then written in 10 days, basically by someone that never had been exposed to any patenting situation before. So it was a strange start. And I do think that this has changed, and there's a lot more focus on how to do this correctly now than then. Then I think the first, we submitted a patent in 2003. Mm-hmm. And we founded the company really late 2006. Nothing really happened in that period besides my PhD thesis. And then some others started working on the technology in academia. And also very limited funding from the start. It was some support from biomedical innovation that was around at that time point as an incubator company looking for good ideas from academia. And I started as CSO, but 20% CSO on top of 100% postdoc position. We basically got funding from the research council to hire one researcher that would do some work in the lab that was slightly more focused on biotech versus academia, but not really much. So to dare to go in a direction like we did with a completely individualized cancer vaccine, which means that you take a sample from a person and those cancer cells, and you characterize what are the mutations in that particular patient's tumor cells, and you go and you actually make one vaccine per patient and then give it back to that patient. It's like so many steps that we needed to figure out in order to get that right. In principle, I think we started as a company more in 2012 and not in 2003 or 2006-7 as we should have. If we had the enough support system around, enough investors around that could fund that we started off with really more of an intention to seek whether this can be an interesting technology also in a commercial setting.
So you spoke about we founded the company. Who's the we? You're not on your own with this, by the sound of things.
Yeah, no, so we are three co-founders. It's me and the two other professors. So those are basically the inventors on that patent that was written in the 10 days. So that's the two supervisors I had during my master thesis and PhD thesis. Those are the co-founders, if you call it like that. But it was then Biomedical Innovation, which is an incubator company that was around those days that had attracted some funding from investors, trusting them to look for potential interesting ideas, then coming out of the TTOs. So it was in tight collaboration with Biomedical Innovation that we started the company, and I started as CSO from basically day one. Yeah.
So Heidi, can I ask you just quickly? We often think about entrepreneurship as a very, you know, lone wolf thing. You know, we know these famous single entrepreneurs, but as Agnetha is saying, it's not often a single person ride, is it? It's quite often a team effort.
And especially now when we listen to Agnetha's story, of course it was her and her supervisors that kind of came up with the idea. But in order to actually implement that idea or get it into the market, or in general getting bright ideas into society, it's not a solo act and it's not a solo journey. You need to connect up to so many different kinds of both actors and networks in order to make that happen. And I also think that entrepreneurs, of course, like Agnetha now, do not make these kind of decisions in economic isolation. It has to be responded to opportunities that are constructed in the context where Agnetha was working. And also, you need to consult and collaborate and get informed, of course, by individuals and professionals and all these different actors that you actually mentioned just now in order to make it all, you know, go ahead and develop.
How was it? You've kind of hinted that you didn't always get a warm response from perhaps one or two people. But, you know, as a female founder, probably still very young. How old were you when this was happening? If you don't mind my asking.
I was 27 when I started as CSO, yeah. Now, as I was young, I never really felt too much on the fact of being like female in the start, except some, you know, presumptions about which role I had when coming into a room. But normally I worked in a setting where people know who they're meeting before we set up a meeting or an interaction. So I don't think in Norway, I don't feel that that has been an issue. Going out of Norway, it was quite surprising for me from the start how different cultures are and how women are perceived and how the systems are set up, basically more to support males than females. So that's been a journey on many levels, I think. But in Norway, I haven't felt that it has been an issue compared to outside of the world. But I think you need to find your own journey. We did have this postdoc career course for female postdocs when I was postdoc, and I was also then part-time CSO. And I don't like to have a lot of focus on the fact of being female versus male, because I think just doing my job and people should see that, and then maybe that can stimulate more females to go in that direction because it's not scary as such. But I have realized over the last few years that my impression of those leading that course were so strict on saying that it's no difference being female or male. Mm-hmm. And also had a lot of focus on that you should never have children. So most of those female postdocs attending that course during the breaks were actually demotivated and say, I don't want to go. I don't want to have a career. I don't want to be a female professor or a female outside of this. So that did not work. So I think it's more important to realize that there are differences and you need to navigate those differences. And I feel it's more my role now to make others coming after me aware of where the challenges are, so that they are prepared and do not feel alone when they see the challenges. Because I did not really like the fact that I felt that I encountered differences that the females in front of me said were not existing.
That's interesting. So Heidi, what are the statistics on female founders, mm-hmm. particularly in these STEM subjects, in even in kind of egalitarian Norway?
Mm-hmm. So if you look at the number of startups in Norway in 2021, it was like around 42,000, I think, startups in Norway. And 28% of them were done by females. So there are some issues here to actually look into. And also when we look at the type of industries that female entrepreneurship, where they are represented, it's mostly in humanities, it's in education. So in that sense, also very different industries from where the typical male founder, start a business. That is often, you know, in technology related areas, in finance and ICT, for example. Mm. And of course, I think that is an issue in itself, you know, the difference between the type of industries a female are represented. Because the type of industry also says something about the ability to actually scale up your company, to get some growth and to get employment and really earn and money from the startup. Another thing that surprises me is also that the level of female entrepreneurs in Norway also differ from other Nordic countries and European countries. We are kind of the lowest. We have the lowest share of female entrepreneurship. And as you say, Susanna, being looked upon as egalitarian context or country, mm-hmm. That is a bit surprising. So I think there are several issues or topics that we need to address in order to kind of close this gap, this kind of gender gaps. Mm-hmm. And as Agnese is saying now, I mean, being a role model, of course, I think young females actually need a role model, seeing that it is actually possible to be an entrepreneur in a scale-up that has global ambitions and really succeeded, like your company has done. So looking also at the numbers of scale-up in the Oslo region, because it's mainly in the Oslo region where we have the scaling companies, I see from the statistics that it's from 1,800 and something companies starting in Oslo in 2021, 196 were scale-up companies. Mm. And most of them come from ICT, but also some from the sector that you represent, like in health tech companies. And again, we are below in numbers compared to countries that would be natural for us to compare with, like, you know, other Nordic countries. Mm-hmm. But still, we are seeing that the gap is also closing and that there's something is happening in the ecosystem, in especially then the Oslo region, with regard to supporting, having actors, having activities that kind of foster, scale-up and startup companies.
Mm-hmm. So, Agnete, did you feel that it would have been nicer to have some of those support structures and ecosystem around when you were trying to do this?
No, obviously. I mean, and there were some of these clusters around, but it was at least my impression of the support system at that time point was more general than specific to the challenges that you're facing as an individual and with your specific project. So it was a lot of, they invited for conferences that were more or less scientific. So it was an opportunity to meet others. But the culture wasn't necessarily like direct help. And when you are a founder, you're busy. So you feel that every single minute is needed to be used on something that is driving progress for your particular program. So I think these recent initiatives that I've support a lot, like the Spark initiative, where you actually get mentors that are involved and getting into your program and your project and look at that specifically and guide you as what's the next step and where should you go with your technology coming from idea and entering to that product step, which is maybe the most difficult one for many. But listening to a talk about patenting, for instance, wasn't helpful for me because I needed someone that knows my patent, my patent portfolio, my platform, where I should go. So I didn't get a lot of that help. I think there are situations like in Denmark, they have this Bioinnovation Institute, for instance, that goes in and gives both guidance, give an ecosystem where there are consultants available that you basically already have qualified, and also supports that with funding that is more significant than what we were able to attract in the early days. So you get a real chance to get experts to help your specific program, and you have sufficient funding to really make the right decisions to understand whether your starting point has a life or not. While we had more drip funding and had to figure out basically who to talk to, which consultants ourselves, with limited support. So this is changing, and changing to the better, which is important for me to see.
Mm. Okay. So you mentioned clusters, but Heidi, what is the definition of a cluster? That's a term we hear a lot, and it's kind of, does it mean a physical geographic cluster, or does it mean a technology type cluster that could be physically dispersed? What do we mean by cluster?
If you look at a cluster program that they have in Norway, the clusters that are defined as clusters are very, differentiated. We talk about more traditional clusters, like the maritime clusters, for example, along the coast, which is based on more, long traditions in Norway, but all of a sudden has become a, not all of a sudden, through many, many years of work in innovations, has become a global center of expertise, meaning that they are kind of the edge of technology that are represented in the maritime area now. Other clusters can be more diversified when it comes to the sector composition, because we see that in growing new areas, for example, aquaculture, now they are kind of pushed towards sustainability and building, fish ponds further at sea. Then they combine technologies from different sectors. So competence from the oil sector, for example, with competence from the fishing industry, combine this and put it into aquaculture. So also building clusters that combine different knowledge and knowledge bases are also so important. So I think the Norwegian government, because what we're talking about now is cluster facilitation. So the Norwegian government by now has at least defined, I think, 33 different clusters. So it's everything from the cod cluster to the fashion cluster, in the Oslo region. So, but again, going back to the definition of what is a cluster? Alfred Marshall, an early economist from the 19th century, he looked at the industry in England, and he saw that very often companies, they agglomerated. They usually found places where other related companies also were located. And he saw that it had some kind of effect, this agglomeration of similar activities. And he said that it was as though something was in the air, as some kind of knowledge, were spread among the actors. So we saw that innovation came out of this, kind of new ideas, and people were both competing and also collaborating on certain things. And of course, a newer definition coming up with Porter's definition is that it is a geographic concentration of interconnected companies with specialized suppliers, service providers, but it can also be universities and others that are important for a certain sector or industry to develop. So, of course, also being an entrepreneur, being in a cluster could help in connecting up to all these things that Agnete just mentioned. Because as an entrepreneur, you often have very, small networks that are linked to people in your proximity. So a cluster that are kind of created can help those linkages, can help you find, the relevant persons, the relevant local supplier, the relevant knowledge institutes, not only locally, but also globally. Mm-hmm. And of course, the need to have global connections, that also varies, of course, depending on the type of industry you represent. Mm-hmm. And the type of industry that Agnete represent is one which I would think of as global from the start, a kind of born global. So being in a cluster, either it's the Oslo Cancer Cluster or the Life Science Cluster, being a facilitator and working with companies in that cluster, I think your biggest role probably is to connect up to the global scene in so many different ways along the innovation journey.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons, so the entire intention with clusters is highly supported and it should work. I think for biotech has been traditionally in Norway a very small industry and a bit bizarre industry compared to others. So I see the clusters maybe having an easier role to do this in other countries where the volume is higher, like in Denmark or in Boston or whatever. So yes, we're born globally and our competitors and our collaborators are in US or in Germany or whatever. Yet there are so few biotech companies in Norway and the funding is very limited. And the number of people are very limited that have expertise in the industry. So there is, in my mind, some sort of a fake competition between biotech companies in Norway instead of realizing that we will grow stronger by collaborating and sharing expertise and sharing know-how and helping each other about the journey. So this is something that we are trying now to be more focused on, although we are extremely busy, but we are asking all these questions. Why do not people now ask us, how did we set up the process? What's our experience from getting the big licensing deals we have with US-based pharma companies? Because it is not, there's just one more company in Norway that's ever done something like something similar. But it's not really a scene for sharing. At the moment. So we're almost forcing ourselves upon people that we are willing to share because we don't see the others as competitors. And they shouldn't be competitors. But I think we just need a higher volume because if we get a higher volume, you get more security and everyone is more global and realize that we are never competing on the same product or the same patient population. It's more a competition of funding from the Norwegian Research Council, competing for employees or competing for money from the generalist investor that don't necessarily know the differences between the technologies. And that's making it more difficult, I think, for the work of the clusters in our industry compared to bigger industries here.
It's kind of an irony, isn't there, that the fewer companies they are, the more they work against each other rather than the more they pull together. You'd almost think it would be, well, there's only three of us, you know, we need to band together for some strength and then get out into the world. But it works the other way because everyone's competing for the same resource.
Yeah, so there are elements there that I think is working against the collaboration, which we would like to change as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned that you had some resource, I think, from Innovation Norway and that sort of thing. Did you feel that when you started to look out to the world to look for collaborators outside Norway, that you had support to do that? I'm guessing from that little laugh that possibly not.
No, yes and no. I think this is one of my, if you've talked to anyone at the Norwegian Research Council and others, they will know me talking about this from before, because there are programs that they have, innovation programs, what they called BIA before, for instance, that basically required us as a small startup biotech company to have another Norwegian partner in order to get funding, which I have been fighting against loudly many times, because we need to succeed as a company, and it's a small industry. We need to select the best partner that can make sure we get a success, and it's not necessarily Norwegian. That would be really a Norwegian company.
Because it's such a small
industry. Because it's a small industry. And I've been fighting that a lot. And there's also some perceptions about biotech and some other industries normally has as an end goal or a part-time goal to have out-licensing deals with collaborations abroad and or being acquired at a certain time point, because it's normally the pharma companies that end up selling the products. That's how the industry is set up. And that's been regarded to be a bad thing compared to other industries, so that the money is not being totally and solely going back to Norway. Because when we out-license something, we will get a part of the product, but we would never succeed. That's how our system is set up. So when we out-license the first product to Genentech, Roche, we got $200 million up front. That, and we do get also a percentage of the royalties. We get millions of dollars for milestones as this move on. That without that, we would still have been a small company struggling. Maybe we wouldn't be around anymore. We don't know. But now we have had the opportunity to translate all those $200 million, which we haven't used yet, to translate that into further value. We've hired lots of new Norwegian employees that learn how it is to be working in biotech. We get those to both get experience from other experts that move to Norway or Denmark and work together with us. They work daily with the team in San Francisco. We also have a deal with Regeneron in New York. So they work with the best people in the world. And we are getting educated and building an industry by that out-licensing deal. And that has also been very difficult to get through, that this is a positive thing if we end up out-licensing. That's part of building the industry.
And it's the way the industry works and the way that small firms evolve and grow in that industry. Yeah. And it's not, oh, well, no, you shouldn't do this with anyone else. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So, yeah. And do you feel that they don't have that same view with other industries, or is that just a sort of policy and they're applying it to you just as they might apply it to, you know, Heidi mentioned the cod industry and the fashion industry or whatever.
Yeah, because you sell cod, right?
I guess you don't from have a license
Norway.
For it,
you don't have a license. So I mean, it's easier and you build factories, etc. So there's been more focus on trying to set up a manufacturing facility in Norway, because that secures employees and you get revenues back to the country. But if you look at how big that value is that we can get from biotech and out-licensing deal and actually get products onto the market in the end, it's a completely different ballgame. But there's not that many in front of us that has been able to show this, but we are, you know, at least trying to be a bit more vocal out there. And I think as an example now, we have out-licensed products, but that's why we are now helping the industry grow and educating people locally and continuing to grow and able to develop more products in the future. So I think maybe our story is helping to get people to understand that it's not just, if we were acquired, it's a one-time thing, and they wouldn't necessarily see the beauty.
So when you were searching for that first, like, really huge partnership, outside Norway with a big company, and how did you do that? How did you kind of make that happen? Because it's a huge step, right? From being a small biotech in a small country with a small industry to being partnering with someone like that.
Yeah. it's a long, long process. And second of all, I think you need to be pretty bold, because as you mentioned, it's a global industry, but many companies start up with a platform. So you can go in different directions, and some are lower risk and some are higher risk. But you need, in order to succeed, you need to be best in the world and or first in the world. That's just the way it is, because that's how biotech is set up. Not just the technology, but we needed to set up manufacturing chains and bioinformatics and a lot of things. But we felt that it was an opportunity for us to show all the different layers of benefits with our technology compared to other technologies. So if we succeeded, we may get the attention of a big player. So that's a risky step, but that's what I at least can explain is why we were able to get the attention from Roche Genentech, and also to get the amount that we get. It has to be pretty unique what you are developing. Then it's a lot of relationship building over time, and you need to manage the fact that you are few, but you know your technology and how to handle that. You're talking to the best experts, and that they are also only people, and it's negotiations, and it's hard and tough negotiations, but it's also negotiations there, trying to find the best solution for both parties. So it took us more than 2 years from starting the initial discussions until the contract is signed. And that's a lot of meetings, and particularly during the pandemic in the end. It's a lot of midnight meetings with lawyers, but transformative for the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's massively kind of credibility building, isn't it, in the industry to have a partner like that straight away.
Yeah.
So in Norway then, Heidi, you were talking about all these different 33 different clusters. Is that really a big part of the Norwegian an effort to boost innovation and entrepreneurship in Norway? It's a policy decision to do that?
Yes, it is. And I think it's one of the most important innovation policy initiatives that there actually are out there. And I think what they try to grasp is exactly what was just mentioned, try to really understand that no size fits all when it comes to innovation policy. You just have to adapt it to the different layers and different kind of knowledge that actually goes in and the dynamic of the overall sectoral innovation system, if you can talk about that. And because we did look into two different clusters in Norway and try to look at their innovation journey and what kind of connections they actually did. So one was the Ocean Technology Cluster, the Global Center of Expertise on Ocean Technology, and the other was Oslo Cancer Cluster. And then following, you know, the development phase and who they actually needed to connect up to and how that differed, and the interaction between the importance of the local, the contextual knowledge or the local linkages compared to the more global ones, they were so different. So, of course, then building facilitator or cluster managers that really can, you know, feel the pulse of what is needed at the sectoral level where they are, it's extremely important. And getting stories, I mean, the different stories and seeing how different, you know, kind of barriers and motivations. I think there are so many things that actually differs in each sector that needs to be taken into account if you are to innovate and grow and all the things we want companies to do based on the policy that we try to enable.
What can the academic community contribute to this, the business schools or the universities?
So first of all, the culture and just welcoming it. And then I think we need to develop, you know, get more people with industry expertise that can actually act as mentors. So there is someone that you can talk to directly about your own program and how to move forward. I think the entire ecosystem needs to mature even more. Mm-hmm. When you talk about females or not, it's not necessarily in academia, but it's... you end up meeting only investors that are male, for instance. There are steps that needs to be done in order to make sure that that you're not the only woman in the room, which for some people is scary. I think for me, I was not, I mean, I was literally told I was not welcome back to academia if I took the step to do the CSO. That's things that maybe can change because I think females are, you know, if you want to generalize, which you shouldn't necessarily, but a bit more interested in the safety net and know what to do if this, if I dare to do this and I fail, what's there to pick me up? And that's difficult in our industry. If you, as me, was not welcome back in academia, then it was not many other biotech companies that would be interested in a CSO that failed. So I think this is important. And I think, as you mentioned, the technology sector is a more high risk, high reward that maybe is attracting males more than females. Okay, everything from salary to support systems. I still have a case with like tax at the right time, which I think is killing a few females more than males as well, where you were in one way almost forced to take up a loan to be a founder and pay taxes. Well, sort of the Norwegian state can get the money at the time, but you will not get your money at that time. And those things, I think, I mean, in general, I think is wrong, but I don't think they are helping more females to take the risk.
And Heidi, a final word to you. What do you think, speaking from a business school perspective as well as an industry perspective, what do you see as ways that we can help the building of these clusters and ecosystems and encouragement generally?
Well, as you say, working at a business school and teaching young students that actually are interested in entrepreneurship and innovation, I think showcasing role models like one that we have here is important. So that is more from an educational level, but also from the government side. I think it's also several things that can be done if you decide to become an entrepreneur. I know there are issues with regard to sick leave and parental leave and these kind of things that are different for an entrepreneur versus a person that is employed. So still there are things to work on then. You also mentioned, you know, the problem with or the issues with getting finance. Statistics and research also show that that is harder for females to get finance. So there is still a lot of topics I think related to enabling startups and also just trying to motivate at least the young people I meet in the classroom to go out there and be bold and go for it.
And clearly, I think some disciplines, they're more welcoming of practitioners. Like I'm just thinking about my own little world of saying, well, I've been an entrepreneur in practice and I'm still allowed to come and do a PhD. No one said, oh, no, you mustn't come into academia. But you had the opposite experience. It's like, no, don't darken our door again if you go off and become an entrepreneur or pursue something non-academic. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting as well. So I'm going to finish by saying thank you so much to our guests, Agnete Fredriksen from Nycode Therapeutics and Heidi Vik from BI Business School. I wish you both a beautiful rest of your day.
This is a BI production. Listen to more podcasts. Go to bi.no/podcasts.